who's Julia.
Thanks.
Hi, everybody. I'm Juliana Monadic. Let's see if I can adjust this so I don't have to lean down. Oh, a bit nervous. I have had the pleasure of speaking here before a few years ago, and it's funny how much more nervous I am now. So if you are new, I mean, as the previous speaker said, you know, what a wonderful thing to do for yourself. You know, before I came into the Fellowship of NA, all I could do was survive. I never had a chance at thriving. And, you know, it's an absolute miracle that I'm sitting here, and I don't know how on earth in 40 short minutes I'm going to be able to put across to you how grateful I am for having found this fellowship. So yeah, you know, higher power, if there's one thing, one message I could carry, you know, it did more than save my life. It helped me create a life beyond my wildest dreams, which is what I would wish for anyone who's new. So sit back and listen, because we have 40 minutes here to get in the 39. Right, so you're probably looking up here and thinking, oh, she looks just lovely. What on earth is she doing here? And that would be a good question. I can answer that. Why am I here? Before coming to the Fellowship of NA, I could not manage my own life. I could not live and enjoy life as other people do. I had to have something different, and I thought I found it in drugs. Okay, and then I placed my drugs ahead of the welfare of my family, my husband, my children. I had to have drugs at all cost. I did many people great harm, but most of all, I harmed myself. Okay, great. 38 minutes. So I'm going to take you through the story. I don't often do the story because I only get 15 minutes under the best of circumstances, but we have a while here tonight. You know, I didn't know this for a really long time, but my mother was an addict. I knew when I was growing up that there was something funky going on in my house, because my mother could sleep face down in the pillows, and when I tried to do it in my bedroom, I couldn't breathe. And I didn't understand how she could do that. And some days she was loving, and some days she was hitting. And, you know, I kind of went in between being hugged and hiding under tables. But what do you know when you're little? You know, you just don't know. And I can assure you that no one said a word to me about it. And so, like most kids, being the, you know, self-centered center of my universe, I was pretty sure it was something that I had done. But I think, you know, you can only live for so long in a situation like that before the pain starts being obvious to everybody around you. And I think early on I wasn't that good at being in pain. You know, it was something I learned to do over time, with before the drugs and then with the drugs. But I was quite clever in school and everything, and so it's interesting that that's the place that I chose to start making trouble. I got caught stealing when I was in year one. My parents had to get caught, brought into school. I mean, what on earth? You know, middle class kid in a middle class school with a very full pencil case. But I needed to go through other people's lockers and their coats to take things. And they, you know, they brought my parents in. And this was way before social services. This was way before it is now. And I'm a teacher. I work in a school. Way before a kid, you know, nicking stuff at that age would, you know, they want to know what was going on at home. They did not, in 1972, they did not care what was going on at home. And so that was when I started being a bad girl. And it's such a weird thing, because I'm actually a pretty good person. And I think that tension between that was really hard when I was a little person, you know. And So, you know, went on for a while where I just got more and more unhappy. And, you know, I really started hating my mother. And there wasn't much I could do about that. My dad was a doctor. He was out of the house all the time. And one day, In the morning, my mother said, you know, went to this party last night. So-and-so, whose name I will not repeat, helped their parents clean up after the party. What do you do for me? And it was like, I'll make you a cup of tea. So I went down and I made a cup of tea and I brought it back upstairs. And she said, go into the basement and don't come up or you won't get your allowance. So I did that with my brother, Jason, wherever you are. And we went downstairs, and it wasn't until my dad came home and he said, did you leave something on the stove? And I said, I didn't. And he told us to go to the neighbor's house. And we went to the neighbor's house, and the fire trucks came because my mother fell asleep smoking after taking a handful of barbiturates and burnt the house down. And even that wasn't enough for us to be told that my mother was an addict. Yeah. So I got left wondering what my part in that was. And, you know, just having thought, I really hate you. And I, you know, there she up and died. Trying to figure out what happened to my mother became like the biggest, not obsession, but like the biggest thread of my life. I never let it go. However, I was in such searing pain. But I remember when my dad took us into the neighbor's house and sat us down on the steps, and he said, you know, your mom's died. And I remember totally vividly this, like, you know those kind of three-quarter showers that are made of glass? It was like this glass descended, and all of a sudden, I didn't ever have to have a feeling again. And I willed that on myself, you know, at 10, just about right, a couple days before my 10th birthday, so very close to now, actually, I willed it on myself that I should never have another feeling again. It was that conscious. But for those of you who have tried never to have feelings, it's a very difficult proposition. Mm-hmm. And they kept coming out, and I was so homicidal. I couldn't figure out. I was so angry. I was like a time bomb. And I remember this woman saying to me at my mother's funeral, she put her hands in a pyramid, my Aunt Nancy, and she said, feelings have to come out the top of the volcano or you'll have a big explosion as an earthquake. And I remember this. It's 40 years or something now. And I remembered it, but at the same time, I thought, you've got to be having me on. So what did I do? First I was really, really angry, and I ran away from home a lot and was quite unkind to everyone around me. My father got remarried to somebody who I didn't get along with, and when I was 13 years old, this girl, Lisa, suggested we go steal some grass from her brother, some gold, what do we call it, bud, some kind of bud. Yeah, it was gold, and it was really beautiful. It smelled really nice. And we smoked that, and it was the answer to all my problems. You know? It was fantastic. I just laid there. I had no feelings. And I thought, you know, I could make this a way of life. And I remember that not long after we were in school, and they showed, like, this video, you know, the kids don't do drugs video, and it was somebody who had taken LSD, and they were, like, seeing flowers, and, you know, and I was like, oh, yeah, that looks good, too, you know. Once the gate was down, I was off and ready to roll, you know. And I want to tell you that there was a lot of great times in there. Because on a very superficial level, it answered a lot of my needs. I was pretty numb. I had a whole bunch of people I could hang out with instead of being at home, which I wasn't having a great time at. So I had this like community of like-minded others, which, you know, look around you, my like-minded friends. That's always been something that has been good for me. And, you know, I was just heartbroken. You know, I was absolutely heartbroken. From way before my mother died, I was just heartbroken. And it turns out that I'm a very loving person, and it's not a way that you can live. So yeah, I tried all these different ways to get my heart's needs met. for the women in the room, you may know this, inappropriate encounters with gentlemen, trying to find love in the dumbest of places. Kept going on and on. Until when I was 16 years old, my father said to me, "You've got what your mother's got. So we're going to put you in psychiatric treatment." And you remember how I quoted, "Why are we here?" My friend Dave says that his favorite reading is We Do Recover, which, we don't read at every meeting. And I said to him, "Yeah, that's not one of the ones I like very much." He said, "Oh, is it because of the whole man's entire history?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, no, you got to read the rest of it." For the first time, A Simple Way has been proving itself. When my parents locked me up at 16 years old, from 16 to 18, in psychiatric care, that was the best they could do. They knew that I had what my mother had, but there was no way, well, now we're in 1979 in the suburbs of Chicago, no one knew. And they weren't willing to cop to addiction. It took many, many years. And so, they wanted me to be safe. They wanted me to be out of the way. And they put me somewhere where they thought I could get the help I needed. But you know who else was in there with me? A room full of addicts. It was all the other kids whose parents had put them somewhere safe. So we used all the time. And I never got one whit better with religion, psychiatry, or medicine, because the core of my problem never got resolved. But it was so confusing to me, because it was like I knew that there was something that was wrong, but I knew it wasn't what they said it was. And so I developed a very, very unfortunate characteristic that came back to haunt me when I tried to get clean, which is that if you looked at me and said, "Something's not right here," I said, "Everything's fine." "No, it's not. You don't know." And, people would be like, "You don't look right." As a matter of fact, the psychiatric label they gave me was called an affect disorder, which means the way you're putting yourself across is pretty funky. So I stayed in there, and then I got out. I went to university. I got jobs. I got married. I had kids. And inside of me, I was heartbroken, People talk about that, there's this God-shaped hole inside of you that you try to fill with all this stuff. All I know is that I couldn't manage to thrive. I had a lot of ideas. It was like I could imagine the life I wanted to have for myself, but I couldn't figure out how to get there. And as the years rolled by and I had some successes in jobs and some failures, mostly to do with my drugs, some successes in relationships and a lot of failures, mostly to do with my drugs, there was this still soft voice inside of me that kept saying, "Hold on, honey, hold on. Someday, in the words of Bob Dylan, everything's going to be different and you will paint that masterpiece." And, I held on and it never came. It just never came for me. The closest I ever got is there were some drugs that I took where God would talk to me. And, you can laugh all you want, but it was a really good experience. I remember sitting under this tree and the tree went, "We love you, we love you." And it was probably the first time that anything had ever said that to me. And it touched my heart. But here's the problem. I had to come down. So it wasn't really a lifestyle choice. You know what I mean? It's like, and I hate coming down. So I couldn't find anything that I could hold on to that was going to be mine, that I could have forever, I did everything right, because I was a bad girl trying to be a good girl, and I got married and I was respectable. And we moved to London, and we were very middle class, and I went to yoga, and, whatever. And then this person saw me, this neighbor of mine, and he was like, "I know who you are." And I thought, "Oh, my God, thank God." And he saved my life. I like to call him my rock bottom, because he took me back to the place where I could find out what it was that was really wrong with me. Because I kept bouncing back to therapists. You know, I kept going back to it. Like, the therapy didn't work the first time, but I kept trying. It was like, you know what? Oh, man, I never gave up. I never gave up. But God's only ever really, except for the time with the tree, let's call that three times. So God's ever talked to me three times that I could identify as my higher power. You know, believe whatever you want. I'm a big old hippie, you know. That's just who I am. So there was the time with the tree. And then the second time, I was shaking and sweating after a three-day run. My husband had gone out of town. He left me with the kids. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to use it. It's all going to be good. And, yeah, I looked in the face of my children, and they looked back at me, and, you know, I became my mother, the thing that ruined my entire life, and that was me, and I could see the fear in their faces, and I could see, oh my God, I was absolutely gutted, you know, and I laid in bed that night, you know, shaking and sweating, and I said, God, God, you know, what can I do, what can I do, okay, what can you... And I swear, but a voice did not come down and said that it's very easy. All you have to do is get off drugs. And I thought, anything but that. Anything. Sweep the floors, do service, go to India, I'm good. Anything but that. Okay, but I knew this person who was clean, and they said, I think you might like it because it's very spiritual. And I thought I was very spiritual because I read tarot cards. They said, it's very spiritual, and there's a lot of writing, and you love to do homework, so you should go. So I went many years ago now, and I walked in. It was just about Christmas time, and I walked in, and everybody was sharing honestly about how they felt about Christmas, and I thought, I am never coming back here. These people are crazy. So I left, and I made it 4 days without using. Very impressed. And I thought, I'm going to do this by my, I mean, you know, whatever. So I tried everything, and then I went back with a tiny bit of humility. And this woman who's to become my first sponsor, she said to me, you're going to have to come more often if you want it to work, right? You can't just come and then come back a couple weeks later. So when I first got clean, I never, ever, ever thought that it was going to teach me how to thrive instead of survive. All I wanted to do was not be my mother. It was like very simple. I wanted my kids not to be scared of me. And it's pretty common, I hear now, that I've been around for a while, going in for somebody else because you don't have enough self-esteem and you don't have enough inner fiber to do it for somebody else. So, you know, thank God that my heart wasn't so broken that I couldn't love my children enough to go for them, whatever. And I came to NA. I did what was suggested. I got a sponsor. I did lots of service. And I attended meetings as regularly as I could, but I really had a lot of trouble in meetings. I had a lot of trouble identifying with other people, and I had a lot of trouble connecting. And I stayed in for 2 years. If you knew me then, and for those of you who are here that did, I had a very shiny recovery. I did tell you that I like to be a good girl. I'm very practiced in doing things right. I set up chairs, I took meetings, I sat on committees. And, you know, I tried to have the most beautiful recovery humanly possible. But it didn't touch the sides, you know, because my heart was not involved in it. I knew little of the matters of the heart, which was kind of weird because when I went into recovery, part of the reason that I was so bereft is that I had created this entire life, you know, that I thought was going to be the life I wanted, and it didn't touch the sides. You know, I was with somebody who loved me, and I couldn't feel his love. I had children who loved me, and I couldn't feel their love. I had friends who loved me, and I couldn't feel their love. Because I still had that three-quarter shower curtain sitting around me that I'd had since I was 9 years old. And I couldn't figure out... not only could I not figure out how to get it off, I couldn't see the reason to get it off, you know? So I did the very best I could for 2 years. And then I announced... with a flourish at a meeting I was secretary of in a committee I was on that I was, you know, was grateful for the service I had been able to provide in the 2 years I was there. And that I knew that it was jails, institutions, and death, but of course this wouldn't be my story. And I, you know, like announced to everyone that I was leaving. And then I flounced off. And, you know, I only wanted to drink alcohol. I didn't want to go back to using. You know that thing about, you know, alcohol is a drug in one ear and out the other. Because I felt like, in my first 2 years, I felt like a dog with my nose pressed against the window of life. Like, life's going on all around, and everybody's doing it, and I'm not doing it, and I'm stuck in NA, and I just can do my time, and it's my punishment because I didn't do my drugs correctly, you know, you know, whatever. So I started drinking the minute I walked out of the rooms. And put down a bottle my first night. I have a journal that I keep for my own humility that's like, I wonder if I've still got it. I wonder if being an NA is going to poison my recovery. You know, it's going to, if I'm ever going to be, oh my God, this like drivel. It took me 18 months before I was so drunk that I was driving to my dealer to score cocaine. And I took the side off the car, trying to find his house, managed to get back to my driveway, woke up 3 days later. There were people photographing it in my driveway because nobody could imagine how you could sustain that kind of damage to a car. It looked like the old sardine tins that you pull away. And I woke up and I had no idea if I killed anybody. I had no idea if the police were going to come. My dad was coming in 5 days for Christmas, which was a treat. And I woke up from that, and it was like, oh, it was like I finally understood that I have a broken off switch. I have a congenital broken off switch. My mother had it, I have it, and my baby brother has it. And I can't control my use of any drugs whatsoever. None, not at all. I will use until I am unconscious. That is my story. As a matter of fact, that's the place I want to go. I don't actually want to be high. I want to be unconscious. And I got it. You know, I absolutely got it. And I thought, well, I'm going to be here for a while now, clearly. How am I going to make this work for me? And I had very few expectations. You know, all I wanted really was to stay clean for the rest of my life. But I never, ever, ever expected to have an awakening of a spiritual nature. I thought an awakening of a spiritual nature was what happened when you stood under a tree on LSD and the leaves told you they loved you. Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought a spiritual awakening was like doing a tarot card reading. And I had absolutely no idea that a spiritual awakening would be so daily, so practical. You know, I'm the kind of addict who would really like to be bigger than they are in true life. And so my spiritual awakening has me on television as Oprah Winfrey with like a network where I have, you know, Super Soul Sunday and all my friends come and we talk about how amazing we are. And I have books and I'm, that's my spiritual awakening. And, you know, maybe that would have been possible for me. It isn't what my higher power showed me, though. You know, it started very small. I understood that I have an illness, that my illness means that I'll use until I'm unconscious, but it also means that I have the ability to stay sick for a really, really long time if left to my own devices. I'm pretty sure that my mother, rest in peace, never intended me to be miserable for the rest of my life. And that wherever she is, if she could come back to me, she would have said, sweetheart, get over it. But I didn't have one tool in my tool bag to live a happy life. And, you know, it started when I did the steps, you know, with and prayed. Like, I pray, still to this day, align my will with yours, help me to, you know, help, God, align my will with yours. Help me to recognize and carry out your will, and please, above all, open my heart. You know that I may be a cool, clear channel for your love and grace, because it turns out that my higher power can restore me to sanity by my ability to be present in my own life, yeah, to be open to whatever happens, and that my the flavor, particular flavor of my insanity is that I would rather feel nothing than be alive. And I have to take a lot of schooling to learn how to find joy in the very simplest of things, which is pretty much all we've got, right? So it was really hard for me in step two to admit that I was insane, because I spent the whole of my childhood with people pointing a finger at me saying, you are sick, you are sick, you're insane, you've got what your mother had, there's something wrong with you. And so all I kept doing, no, there's not, no, there's not, no, there's not, yes, there is, no, there's not, yes, there is. So for me to be able to cop to being insane took a couple of rounds of steps. I'm not going to lie. First time round, I thought step two was pink and juicy and involved the goddess and nature devas. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get to until my second round that I was. I have the capacity to be profoundly insane and to sustain that for a long period of time. Took me. I didn't have the humility for that. I didn't get that till my first six and seven, pretty much. But then my first step three was life-changing. Because how could I possibly turn my will and my life over to something that killed my mother, right? I mean, how do you do that? And my sponsor said, you need to write a resentment to God. You need to just, you know, get it all down. And, of course, I still have that. It's the most precious piece of paper I own, you know. You killed my mother. You ruined my childhood, whatever. And I got to step four, and my sponsor said to me, sweetheart, jails, institutions, and death, baby. It wasn't your higher power. It was the drugs. And I went to my dad, and I started asking questions about my mother. You know, what really happened there? And I found out, you know, about the amount of drugs she used and about the time that she broke into his medical surgery and stole the morphine and they had to blame it on the cleaner and sack the cleaner. You know, I started hearing the true story, and it was life-changing. And that it was part of my step four was the most incredible blessing, because I had sat across the table from people off my nut on drugs and, you know, blah, 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 telling my story all the time. My story, my dead mother, you know, the fire, blah, 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 my psychiatric internment. But it was so dry, there wasn't a drop of juice left in it. That first step four, finding out about my mother, scraping the surface, learning how much of it was not my part, you know? But then what was my part? That I can hold on to stuff for the longest of times. How satisfied I can be with half a life. How I'm willing to tolerate living a life without love. How I'm happy to be in a loveless marriage. How, you know, I have no problem ruining the life of my children. I mean, it was pretty shocking. So when I got to six and seven, you know, it was very hard to deal with. And actually, I will say this, that my first step four, my asset list, was longer than my list of defects, because I just couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear it. I was so fragile. But in step five, I had the most beautiful experience, which is that I spoke honestly to another person. You know, this woman, bless her heart, is probably, you know, I love her so much. And I might love her so much because she was my first love. You know, she was like the first person that I ever said, I'm so frightened, you know, I'm so frightened and I'm so lonely and I'm so weird and I don't know if I can do this and I don't know if I have what it takes to actually be with other people. And she said, oh yeah, me too. And, you know, and it was something. Yeah, six and seven, I did them to the best of my ability. I'm going to do them again real soon. It's going to look very different. I made a list in step eight, and it was as thorough as I could be. Of course, I put on more people than were necessary because I'm a good girl. You know, it was like everybody I ever met, everybody I ever breathed on. You know, every school I went to, the teachers that I wasn't paying enough attention in front of. And she was like, you know what, sweetheart, let's dial it down a little bit, you know. And the most powerful amend that I made has been, in some ways, to, like, I don't know, is it to myself, is it to God, is it to my husband? It's to something that has more integrity than my illness, you know? I made a commitment in that step nine to amend my behavior. And the repercussions of that I expect to feel for the rest of my clean time. For instance, the amend to my husband. It's going to take me years and years and years to become as present as and as loving as I have the capacity to be. It's going to take me a lot of soul searching to be able to be vulnerable and intimate in my marriage. I have become, as part of my amend to myself, fully self-supporting instead of being on marital benefits, which I have been on for many, many years, which brought me a career, and it's been an amazing thing. I went back to school and got my graduate degree. I have a great big job. It's not Oprah Winfrey, but I'm a dyslexia consultant, and I sit with children who have trouble reading, who think that they might hate themselves, and I sit with them because you can't tell me nothing about hating yourself. And we go real slow. And, so what happened is my job became service, and the therapeutic interaction of one being helping another being. So that was like an amend to my, false ideals. My amend to my family goes on. I apologized to my father, who accepted my apology. And by the time I got to step 11, I felt like I was getting married. I felt like my heart had opened enough that I was able to make this commitment to my higher power to, like, continue thriving and whatever that might mean, which, in fact, is sitting here tonight and carrying a message, even though I'm a little shaky. And I always feel weird sitting. I don't feel weird talking in front of a crowd, but I feel weird telling the truth. As the previous speaker said, my story is horrific. And my story is horrific. But the disease of addiction ravaged my life. It ravaged the life of my mother. And it's ravaged the life of my brother. Should this ever make it onto vinyl, or however we press it. I'd like to send a copy to my brother, who is in jail right now. He also looks nice and pretty like this. He went to Harvard, got a law degree, worked for the government as an environmental lawyer, as a COO for a company, and is in jail. Because that's what our disease does to us. It was the alcohol that took him there. So I was thinking before I got here, like, what if, I haven't lived in the same country as my brother. He's getting clean somewhere else. What would I want to say to carry, what message would I carry if I could press this on vinyl and send it to my brother in Virginia Beach? And I think it's that, that for me, for this addict, it was the thing that I couldn't do the first time round that's been my saving grace, and that's been fellowship. Not because people save me, and not because I need people to save me, but because my higher power doesn't contact me very often. There was a third time. I'm not going to get into it here, but it can't call me on the phone. And the best way that my higher power speaks to me is through other people. And my higher power loves me very much and wants me to be well and happy. And so that would absolutely include being able to connect with other people so that my heart can be open and free and so that I can keep learning, And the first time I was in fellowship, I couldn't take a telephone number from another person. I couldn't say hello to anybody next to me. I couldn't, I didn't have the skills. But it's the part of my recovery that I'm hoping will continue to grow more for me, because there's something in fellowship. My higher power dwells, my sponsor always says, the heart of NA beats when two addicts share their recovery honestly with each other. And for me, I'd extend that, and I would say that, I'm an addict and I'm a human, and that anytime two people share honestly together, when their hearts beat together, higher power is present and miracles can happen. And I want more than anything else to be the person who can be in the position to have more changes come in their life. So in order for that to happen, I need to be with other people. I find that so tricky. I can be very frightened by other people's behavior. I can be really influenced. I'm scared of anger. I'm scared of confrontation. I can be really scared about saying who I am. I'm scared of vulnerability. The list goes on. So it is a tall order. But the only place that I can do this is in fellowship. I can't go to my room and just meditate by myself and never go to a meeting, because even though it makes me feel better, there's no balance to what I have found is my capacity to be insane. And, you know, since I got clean, as I said, you know, I've gone to graduate school, I've developed a career, I've become fully self-supporting, I've been able to call for some changes in my marriage that were long overdue, that have been really hard won, that for which I've had to stand very firm. I've raised two daughters, one of whom's going to university next year. I might just be able to let her go. I've made peace with my higher power. I'm in contact with my family. But most of all, you know, I'm giving back something. And, you know, that's beyond my wildest dreams. I am by nature a selfish, selfish girl. And to be able to, you know, live a life that's truly good, to never have to wonder now that I have the process, never have to wonder, you know, am I good or am I bad? Am I a bad girl or a good girl? You know what? I'm a really complex individual with a lot going for her and some, you know, real problems to work through. But I have at my disposal some fantastic tools, a fellowship program, and, you know, as I said in the beginning, how could I possibly in 40 minutes tell you how grateful I am and how much my life has changed? And, you know, I couldn't have done it without you, so thank you for letting me share.